Welcome to Karma Has Spoken. We have an amazing podcast filled with inspiration and courage. Keep listening later in the show when I sit with Casey Mehta and talk about his role as a caregiver to his wife who is battling Alzheimer's. It is a heartbreaking and inspirational true tale of selfless love. But first, Karen Buscemi is the founder and president of the Detroit Garment Group, a nonprofit that provides education and opportunities for Michigan's fashion community. She's also the CEO of Detroit Sewn, a cut-and-sew manufacturer based in Pontiac that Karen created to fill a hole in southeastern Michigan's fashion industry. In addition to her passion for fashion, Karen is the author of the novels The Makeover and Saturday Nights at the God Cafe. She just came out with another novel, All That We Hide. Hi, Karen.
Hi,
you're Danielle. Also my former boss.
Well, you are.
That's kind of true. There's all sorts of history here. And I think we both worked at the Ritz-Carlton at the same time, right?
No, not at the same time. Okay. You came after me. I was on the opening team.
Oh, I was the next wave.
Yeah.
That was a big deal to be on the opening team.
Oh, yeah.
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 You, Elliot Broom from the DIA, Luigi Bruni.
Right? Who we came together so many years later.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
And so at that time, I mean, that was a huge deal, that hotel opening, the line wrapped around the building just for interviews.
I was in that line.
And then what was your job?
I served high tea in the afternoons, and then I worked the bar in the evening.
That's
so that was
gig.
The best job because I had all the celebrities in the bar.
Wasn't that the best?
Yeah. Duran Duran was my very first celebrity the first week we opened. Yeah. And you couldn't show anything. I mean, you were a professional.
Yeah.
So you'd say, may I get you a jacket, Mr. LeBon?
Certainly my pleasure.
Yes, my pleasure.
I always say, I tell you what, though, that training to work at the Ritz-Carlton was a bit like a cult, but it has turned out to serve me so well.
Don't you still use it today?
All the time. Probably almost daily, I would say. So I worked at the concierge desk and I would see some of the celebs going in and out. I would say baseball players could be a little shady. I saw some things. But now you're here to talk about your new book.
Yes.
I am well into it. We took I think it was a bit of an oath earlier. You promised not to tell me what happens next. I have about 100 pages left and I am loving this, All That We Hide. A lot of people have ideas. A lot of people want to write books. It doesn't actually happen. As I'm reading this, because I know you, I'm constantly thinking and wondering about your process. What is the discipline? How do you sit down and actually make this happen? The amount of detail in the story is extraordinary.
Thank you.
How does this happen?
Well, I think it happens all different ways. And to be honest, I have so many ideas for books in my notes app on my phone. I'm not sure that I will get to all of them as long as I'm on this planet. This one was really interesting. I was sitting at my kitchen table working on my laptop, and my next door neighbor came over to give us back our house key. He was watching our cats while we were on vacation. And I don't know, he was talking to my husband. I don't know how the conversation started, but he started talking about the fact that his mom and dad met in a tuberculosis sanatorium.
Wow.
Right? And so, and it just like got me. And he was talking about the fact that they were there, I want to say maybe like 10 months, and they fell in love while they were there, and they ended up getting married and, you know, were married for decades. And in that moment, it just hit me, and I started writing notes right then and there.
This gives me goosebumps. That's my story. You just knew.
Yeah. And then, you know, and then obviously you have to develop it, but I'm not an outliner. A lot of authors write full outlines and they know everything about the book really before they dive into it. I'm a freeform writer. I just start. I like to see where the story takes me. So I don't necessarily know where it's going to go.
So you can't wait to see where the story is going to take you. I can't wait to see where the story is going to take you. So what is your process? Because I'm wondering if inspiration strikes at all times, moments. Are you driving
for
down the road and dictating to Surrey? And I don't know about you, but Surrey hates me. I dictate one book and come out with something else. I mean, what is your format? What is your process for collecting all of your ideas?
So I just start, and then along the way, same thing. I can be on an airplane. I can be anywhere, and I'll get an idea for part of the book. So I just constantly take notes, and then I refer to them. And of course, like I write all kinds of notes down about the character as it starts to develop, you know, so that I know as I'm writing, oh yeah, that character's got short brown hair and this one has this, you know, little thing that he does with his face, because it's really easy to forget or to mix them up. So I just take a lot of notes along the way.
Where are you keeping all of these notes? How do you keep track of your notes and kind of frame all of this for yourself?
So it'll be, I use my notes app like nothing else, but it might be, you know, I'll just write like chapter 8. This is, you know, where she's going with this, and don't forget to add this in, and her mom's going to do this. And I just go back and I look at my notes.
You know, it's so interesting. I remember, oh no, I actually saw Ellen Nordebrand, who, you know, is an author and has done, you know, tons and tons of novels, and she can only write longhand and preferably in some sort of a vehicle. So she lives on Nantucket and she will take the ferry back and forth to write. And that's just her process.
That sounds therapeutic.
Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. Josh Malerman, who we've interviewed on the show, who wrote Bird Box, just gets up early. He gets a large coffee and he writes and writes and writes, and he can leave and come back and just write and write. I would be so easily distracted. I think the process is fascinating. So what is next for you?
Oh my goodness. I don't even know what's next for me. Like I said, I have so many stories I want to write, and I'm trying to decide which one I want to write next, because there's a couple that are really vying for my heart. So we'll see where it goes.
So now, how many books have you written?
As a solo writer, I've written 5 books, 2 nonfiction, and then 3 novels. And then I had a client that I wrote 3 novellas for that he used in his workshops, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite to write?
Oh, novels for sure. I can write it all and I enjoy the process of all of them. But to have an idea that just really moves me and to just like create those characters and for me to find out what happens to them, you know what I mean? Like, it's just as exciting.
And you're really writing in addition in all formats. So you've been a magazine editor. Mm-hmm. That's where you're my boss, mm-hmm. going back to the beginning when I wrote a column for you. And you've contributed to a lot of national publications. Mm-hmm. And there's such different styles of writing, from doing research and doing an article to doing a book. What are you the most drawn to?
Well, I'm most drawn to novel writing, but I do like creative writing, copywriting. I love headline writing. That was one of my favorite things to do as a magazine editor, was just to write, you know, lights out headlines. That was really fun.
I could see that. Mm-hmm. Did you ever teach? You would be an incredible teacher.
I did not teach writing. I've taught other things.
Well, you teach many things. Well, of course, with the sewing and fashion. Yeah. I mean, you're always teaching. You're always mentoring. So thank you for stopping by.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I would love to talk to you more, but I need to go finish my book now.
Enjoy.
And I want everyone who's listening to download it or buy it. I like paper, but it's just, I can't put it down. So I've got to go read my book. Lena Horne said, "It's not the load that breaks you down. It's the way you carry it." You know the frustration when you open the cupboard and your favorite snack is missing, the one you've been thinking about and craving all day? Now, imagine that's your mind. Imagine reaching for a favorite memory or experience or the name of the person you love the most, and it's gone and you're powerless. Too many people we love are slowly and consistently being robbed of their most valuable asset, their mind, their memory. Now, if you haven't already, imagine watching this happen to someone you love, a parent, a grandparent, a friend, a spouse. What would you do? How would you care for them? Casey Mehta is living that experience as he cares for his wife, Sumi, and chronicles their journey in his blog, My Journey with Sumi. Thank you for being here, Casey.
My pleasure.
This is such an important story. It's so important that you're sharing your journey. You know what? Take us back. How did you and Sumi meet?
Oh, that's a long story.
I've been researching you. I actually love this story. And so I know people will sometimes ask you if it was an arranged marriage. And
right.
You say, well, yes and no. So tell us your love story.
Okay, well, I first came to the USA in September 1970. And before I came, like any Indian parents, they would want their children to get married before they leave India. So they, you know, they're settled. So in my case, I came to USA. I wasn't married. I studied, got my master's degree. And then in 1974, I went back. I got my green card.
And I just have to tell our listeners, you were getting your degree, your master's at Berkeley.
That's
and
right.
How much was your tuition at that time?
At that time, it was $470 per quarter.
I mean.
Yeah. And you can take as many as 18 credits.
Oh, wow.
So there were some students who wanted to finish in two quarters,
mm-hmm.
36 credits, but they had a minimum requirement. Then you have to take three quarters.
Okay.
So what people would do is they finish the 36 requirement.
Uh-huh.
In the third quarter, they golf, bridge.
They had it all figured out. You earn your master's.
Yes.
And then you go across the country.
Yes.
And you got a job, and
yes.
Then take us from there.
So from my job, I worked there, and they sponsored me for the green card, which I got in 1974, and that was one of the happiest days in my life. So once I got the green card, my folks in back home, they say, okay, now it's the time to come back. So I went back to India, and in those days, it was very customary to have arranged marriage. In my case, yes, they had picked up somebody to, you know, meet me. And I met that particular girl, and in a very short meeting, I was too new to India in a way. It was a cultural shock in reverse after going after 3 years. And in my mind, I had this, you know, future mate who could be very nicely built, like a Western girl, but at the
yeah.
same time, a lot of Indian, you know, qualities.
Yeah.
So I was looking for an Eastern West blend, you
and
know.
And so in just 3 years, you had become very Americanized.
That's right.
And I think I read that from your parents' house, it was about a half hour ride to the airport, and you would go to the airport just to use the bathrooms.
That's
because
correct. Yes.
They were more comparable to the American kind of facilities and everything you had become used to.
That's correct.
So now you're back there. Your parents have, like you said, have picked someone out for you.
Right.
You met her. You said this, she's not the one.
Somehow, you know, it's like one of those things in life. You just can't quantify, justify. You just have a gut feel, or you just have a feeling that, you know, this person is not for
me. So was that difficult for you to tell your family?
Yes, it is very difficult. Yeah. You know, it's like basically now they have arranged everything, they've checked out everything, and now you are saying no to the whole arrangement. So it's like upsetting a lot of
so
people.
So was the other family mad at your family?
I'm not sure. I don't
okay.
know.
Okay, we don't worry.
Figure. Yes, yeah.
And so you just had a feeling there was someone out there. And so you grabbed your brother and you were going to go and you were going to find her.
That's right. So we on our own, we were, you know, searching. So my brother and one of my cousin, he seemed to know one girl. He said, you know, that could be a good match for me. So we just, you know, on our own, we just, you know, went to their house, knock on their door. And
they weren't expecting you.
No, it was just a cold call, we call it, you know. So we just knock on the door and we said, you know, we didn't ask for, you know, meeting her, so we want to see her brother.
Uh-huh.
Her brother wasn't there.
No, wait, did she answer the door?
No, she did not answer the door.
Okay.
At that place, yeah.
But she was there.
No, she was in a different place, yeah.
Oh, okay.
So next day we, you know, we rendezvous, you know, we take a bus ride to the next place, and her brother was supposed to meet us at that place. And he didn't show up. So now we were wondering what to do, you know. So we just went on our own anyway. So we knocked at the place, you know, second place. And there, you know, she answered the bell and she came to the door.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a little high. So, you know, I could look up kind of. So, and she kind of seemed very tall girl. So I said, well, at least she's tall, you know. So
because that was on your new Americanized list.
That's
you wanted
right.
someone who was tall.
Tall, right.
Okay.
So we asked for her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And brother hadn't come there. We knew that he wasn't there. So
mm-hmm.
he's not there. So he said, we'll come back.
You're
so
a then sly dog, Casey.
So they figured out why we had come, you know. And then in the afternoon, we came back. And we just, you know, I came with my brother-in-law. He was living close by. So it's you need somebody like older, you know, elder or older,
mm-hmm.
who has more weight, you know, in this situation. So he came, and then I think
he was your wingman.
That's right. Yeah, you're right. So, and after that, I think they... You know, we proposed. I mean, you know, we sort of made an arrangement.
Uh huh. So you met her. So when was the first time you talked and you?
Okay, so now
this all now happens very quickly.
That's right.
Right?
So
okay.
Coming from USA now, you can't, you know, it's arranged, but you want to meet her. So it was very unusual in those days to asking for a date. So you go out for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go out for lunch, normally somebody accompanies her, you know, from her side.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that everything is okay.
Chaperone,
yes,
to watch
right.
out for the sly dog.
So in this particular case, nobody showed up. So it was her and me. So we went out for lunch. I asked you questions, you know, and I mean, it was so sudden that, you know, she was very, very bubbly, very, you know, effervescent. She was very easygoing. So those personality kind of, you
and
know.
And very bright. She was in college and involved in protests.
That's right.
Right?
Yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So first time we met, and still I wasn't convinced. So we then came back. I came back to Mumbai and then started looking for maybe, you know, maybe she didn't have enough background in the English, so she didn't study in English. And I thought, you know, living in America, English will be a very, English is a must, you know. Then we came back to Mumbai and we looked around.
So you kept looking.
Just kept looking. Uh-huh. And then in those days, you know, the pollution wasn't there, and we had a place where there was a terrace on the top. And in summertime, you can sleep up, you know, in open, you know. So you sleep in open, you can see the stars and you can see the moon and everything, you know. And many nights I would just sleep there, and I would just, she would come back to me, you know, that, oh, this is the girl, you know, maybe. So after looking around, now I wanted to say yes, but at the same time, I didn't want to say yes without, you know, seeing second time.
Yeah.
And I knew when I went for the second time, I was going to say yes. Mm-hmm. So we met second time, we said yes. And that was on her birthday, which was happened to be 8th May.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was on a leave from work and I didn't want to stay too long. So I said, we need to get married as soon as possible. Her father says, you know, come back after 6 months. I say, if I go back, you know, there is no guarantee I'll come back, you know. So on 11th of May, we got married.
So 3 days later.
3 days later.
3 days after her birthday. And that was after her 20th birthday?
That's right. She had turned, she just became that 20th.
And your family was there, but your mom barely made it.
That's right. There was a railway strike in those days, you know, the All India Railway strike.
Uh-huh.
And my parents were in Mumbai. And my mother could not make it because my younger brother was sick. So my mother took a bus, and then he rode on the back of my friend's motorbike.
So your mom came to your wedding on the back of your friend's motorcycle.
That's right.
Wheeling in at the last minute.
Right. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Indian wedding, but the wedding ceremony is not like, you know, priest says, I do, you know, big husband and wife. Indian wedding is you go around the fire 7 times.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you complete the 7th round, you are not legally married.
Mm.
So we were like making the rounds. I don't know if it was the 3rd or 4th round. And my mother comes into the area and she wants to see the bride. So she lifts her veil and says, I want to see your face, you know. And she said, okay, go ahead, proceed.
Oh.
So, you know, there was suspense also. I mean, she would not say no, I knew that. But, you know, still, you know, who knows.
Oh, yeah. But then she saw Sumi's sweet, bubbly personality and that irresistible face.
That's right.
Oh, and then you love photography. And you will put some on online so our listeners can see. You have the most beautiful pictures that you had taken of her then on your honeymoon a few days later.
That's
and,
right.
And I really encourage everyone who's listening to find a moment to see these pictures, because in these pictures, you so beautifully captured her joy.
Yes.
Right? So you hear this story, and as Americans, it's a little hard for us to kind of wrap our mind around someone getting engaged and married in 3 days to someone they'd only met twice before. But in these pictures that you captured, like I said, they so beautifully demonstrate her joy and happiness in that moment.
Sure.
And so
is.
Then you bring her back here, and you have 2 kids.
Yes,
and
right.
You're raising your family.
Yes.
And then fast forward us to 6 years ago.
So 6 years ago, my wife, I was noticing few lapses in her in way of when I come from overseas trip and she would come to pick me up at the airport. You know, she would be a little late. I said, what happened? She said she missed the exit. And if anybody who has driven to the airport from I-75 to 94, it's very easy to miss that exit, you know. So I said, well, that's normal, you know. Or once in a while, we would meet in the restaurant, say, okay, let's meet somewhere, and she'll be late or something. And that's, again, it's very normal. She may have traffic or, you know. But the trigger point came in April of 2013. She was going to a friend's place for their grandmother's birthday. Mm-hmm. And it was 109th birthday.
Wow.
109th.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, you know, I was a little apprehensive that I, you know, that she may or may not be okay, but she went anyway. And 45 minutes later, I got a call that she's looking for direction, asking me direction. I was trying to give her direction. Maybe she was, you know, by the way, she had bad hearing in one left ear and she had a brand new phone also at that time. So maybe she wasn't able to figure out, or you know, I wasn't sure. So she could not understand the direction. And maybe she got frustrated, and maybe I was frustrated also a little bit in those days. So she didn't, you know, answer my phone. So I called my friend. They went looking for it. I called police. You know, they said, we'll look for it. But I don't know what they would look for it. You know, it's not like a serious incidence. So this was around 1 o'clock. And she came home around 5 o'clock. So those 4 hours were very excruciating, you know, in my life, not knowing where she might be, what may have happened to her. So when she came home, she was really distraught. And I didn't have guts to ask, you know, what happened or where she was. So that was, I knew that this is the time, you know, we need to see doctor.
And so up until that point, and I'm sure you had been observing other things in her behavior and throughout the day, was she noticing, or would she tell you that she was noticing any sort of a change?
No, unfortunately, this disease, I think people, you know, and I go to support groups and everything, so I hear a lot of stories. Surprisingly, the person with the disease, they may notice it, but they don't quantify it. You know, they know that something is happening to them, but it's, I don't know, it's a very touchy subject to discuss between husband and wife, you know.
Yeah.
So some trigger point happens and then you know, you want to take them. In many cases, they don't even after going to doctor, they don't think that, you know, something is wrong with them. So there's a denial, you know.
Yeah. So do you think the denial is, maybe it's a combination, is the denial a choice because they're scared and they don't want to believe that this is happening to them? Or is it part of the disease where they really don't realize what has happened? So
yeah, it's very difficult to speak for the person with the disease, what they think or what they go through. You know, for me to do that, because I'm a care partner.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what may be going through their mind, but it could be a combination of both.
Mm-hmm. And so then you went to a doctor.
Yes.
Right. And then what was that experience?
So my wife was starting to lose a little bit of English around that time. And so happened the doctor was of Indian origin and he would speak the same language, Indian language we would speak. So that worked out well. So he would, you know, converse with her in Gujarati, which is one of the Indian language. And he asked few questions and he, you know, do the standard, you know, memory test and everything. You know, they have a 3-word recall. They mentioned 3 words, let's say butterfly, honey, orange, you know, and then they talk further and say, what were those 3 words, you know, and you have to, you know, recall those, you know, butterfly, honey and orange. And if you don't recall that, you know, maybe you call one or something, a doctor might prompt, you know, what was the first was butterfly, what was the second word, then they come back. So she had a 0 out of 3 in the first recall, you know. So that was one. They asked for simple arithmetic addition or something, you know, and she wasn't able to do that, you know, or struggling. But I think everybody must have heard about the clock and the cube, you know. So clock is, they ask you to draw a face of the clock, you know, and put where the 12 o'clock is, 1 o'clock, you know, you have to put those numbers. And then doctor says, show me 4 o'clock. So you have to put one hand at 4 and one at 12 o'clock. And she had struggled in that one also. A doctor will draw a cube and say, you replicate the cube on the side. Now, you know, she was not able to do that. You know, so after all those tests, those were a cognitive and other tests. Then, of course, you go for MRI and you go for the PET scan. So PET scan was the real final test where, you know, they can see the damaged brain.
And what are they looking for in those tests?
They see the function of the brain and they see, you know, again, medically, I cannot be, you know, 100% sure. But the healthy brain and the damaged brain or brain with the disease, there are black spots or black marks, you know, on the brain, you know. So those are the where, you know, the brain is damaged.
And so this must have just hit you like a truck, right?
Yes.
It must have just, your whole world is suddenly changing. It's about to change. The doctors have just confirmed. What was your reaction?
So again, you know, like there are different models, they say, of, you know, grief or something, or some you hear some news, shocking news. So one is a model where they say you go through the 5 stages.
I wrote these down from your notes: denial, anger, guilt, depression, acceptance.
Right, but this particular one is more, you know, well known. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she was a psychiatrist.
Okay.
And she said when somebody's near death, you know, so you go through the 5 phases, you know.
Yeah.
And those 5 phases are, first is denial.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you think maybe, you know, nothing's going to happen or this, you know, whatever. Then it's anger. Then comes the bargaining. Bargaining being, you know, God, if, you know, she survives, I'm going to change my lifestyle or I'm going to do something. I'm never going to drink, you know, whatever. So you bargain, you know. Then comes the depression and then the acceptance. Now, Sumi is not at near-death situation, so I would like to maybe talk about a simpler model.
Mm-hmm.
I call it Sarah.
Okay.
S-A-R-A.
Okay.
So Sarah being the shock, A being the anger,
yeah.
R being the reflection, and A being the acceptance.
Mm-hmm.
So in my case, I wasn't kind of angry about it, you know, situation. Okay, this is the situation. This is what the doctor is saying. There was some denial in the sense that, okay, my wife may not be, you know, she never drew anything. So maybe cube is not the right test for her.
Sure.
You know, she, you know, normal people might fail
the
test.
Well, and I feel like you also, you probably wanted to protect her.
Right.
Right.
So there was some denial from that viewpoint. There was no anger on my part, you know, why this is happening. Of course, you ask question, why me? So my wife would ask, why me? You know, why is happening to me? Mm. And all I can say, you know, we'll be all right, you know. As a matter of fact, when doctor was telling us that, you know, in front of her, that she may have this, you know, disease, I got emotional. Tears came in my eyes in front of doctor, you know. So my wife gets up and she consoles me.
Oh.
So you know, she's so loving.
Mm. I've been curious, you have two kids and they're, yes, both in California.
Right.
Yeah. And one's engaged.
Yes.
Right? And you know, what was she like? She worked for a while at the Gap.
That's right.
Right. And so tell me about her as a mom, as a friend. And when she moved to America and she learned the language, what was her personality like here?
She was always very easygoing. By the way, her name is, you know, long name is Sumitra.
Mm-hmm.
And Su means good. Mitra means friend.
Mm.
So she just justified her name very well. She was a real good friend.
Wow.
Yes.
And as a parent?
Easygoing. As a parent, she was loving. You know, as a father, you want your kids to be, you know, achieve something. You're more demanding, you know.
Yeah.
So she was a balancing force, you know, loving and caring and never got on kids on any case. So, you know, it's like any, most of the kids, they love their mother anyway.
Of
you know,
course.
So she was very soft-hearted, you know, easygoing. She never got angry about anything. She never complained about anything. You know, I wrote somewhere that in old days I took Dale Carnegie course, you know, and this,
yeah,
Dale Carnegie says 3 C's, you know, if you have practiced 3 C's, you will win friends and you'll influence people. And so one is never complain, never condemn, and never criticize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she was practicing those three without...
Just naturally. Just a joyful,
yeah,
person.
Yes.
And then comes this diagnosis.
So going back to the Gap, she worked at the Gap store and she worked in the children department.
Oh.
And she loved just taking care of, you know, some mom comes and, you know, she would, you know, suggest what would look nice on them and everything. Mm-hmm. And it so happens that, you know, as an employee, you get, I believe, 30% discount. All our friends were just, you know.
because she was a good friend.
That's right. So they would just, you know, she would buy coupons for everybody when, oh, the sale comes out, you know. So.
And she's joyful and loving and social and nurturing and taking care of people. And now, and you're an engineer and,
yes,
you're very literal and you're figuring out solutions. And now with the diagnosis, the roles are changing.
Right.
And then tell us about starting the blog.
Before I, you know, talk about the blog, you know, there are, I think some changes are happening. There are two ways one can deal with it. So one is, whatever the things are, you are for it. So in other words, you know, let's say I want to do something for her. So what can I do? Okay, I can research what the disease does.
And this,
you know,
is the engineer in you, right? That's going, let me figure this out.
Right. So let me figure this out. Let me talk to the expert, you know. So you go through this. Let me educate myself. Let me read up everything. And you go through this route in the beginning, then a time comes that, you know, you read everything and all the books, I must have read about 15, 16 books, you know, and all the books come to the same conclusion. You know, the cause is not known and there is no cure. So once you go to, you know, say, okay, what can I do for her? Then you shift from what can I do for her? What can I do with her?
Hmm.
You know, she's not a problem to be solved, but she is to be loved and cared and, you know, taken care of.
Mm.
So that shift happens, you know. So in my journey, first 2 or 3 years, I was, you know, looking for. Now, you know, I'm doing with all the things.
And you're chronicling this journey.
That's
right. My journey with Sumi. And I think one of the things that was so interesting to me is at the beginning, one of the reasons, I wrote this down here somewhere in my notes, that you started writing, chronicling this journey, but you also did it in case you started faltering or you needed help.
Right. So, you know, I had 3 objectives. So one objective is increase the awareness. And even, you know, the Alzheimer's Association and a lot of other associations, they also, you know, encourage, you know, increase the awareness, be an advocate for, you know, this disease. So my first goal was, okay, you know, this particular disease is considered taboo. You know, it's a stigma, especially in the Asian culture, Indian, Chinese. You know, when something happens in that culture, they just hide it. You know, they just keep the person totally locked up or whatever. You know, they don't even talk about it. So I thought maybe, you know, my coming out and, you know, talking about it being of, you know, I consider myself bicultural. So, you know, I have two cultural. So, you know, I find myself very lucky to be that way. So I put my American hat and I say, okay, no, I have to be open about this and I have to, you know, increase the awareness. The second was when I'm writing, you know, I can write about our lives, my thoughts and feelings. And that I found that, you know, I'm not brooding on my, you know, misery. I'm writing it, so it's out of my mind. It's on paper and it's out. And then I ultimately found it more therapeutic. And the third point you mentioned was I may falter. And if I'm falter, you know, one way people, you know, when somebody talks or somebody writes, somebody can make out that, okay, this person is not doing well and he himself or herself needs help. So that was my third objective.
And I think that's such an important point. It's so important for our listeners that, you know, absolutely, Alzheimer is just devastating. And, you know, probably almost everyone listening knows someone who's been affected. But I think the effect on caregivers is huge, right? And that's something that you've experienced. What do you think the biggest misconception is, or what do you want people to understand about caregivers and their experience? And I know you're not a person who feels sorry for themselves. You're very practical and you're documenting this, but I think it's important for people to understand what the experience is truly like for a caregiver, because it is exhausting. I like that you said, you know, your approach to be an effective care partner is two-pronged. One, it's creative problem solving, and two, it's emotional acceptance.
Right.
And we can talk a bit about that later. I think with the creative problem solving, you know, one of the things that you've done in your house is, you know, you changed the floors, the flooring, because it was easier to clean. You put a ramp in the house so it was easier for her to have access. You put some padding around the walls so if she bumped into something, she would be protective. So, you know, you are, and what I've read about you are so intentional in your approach to, I wouldn't even say you're solving problems. You're so proactive that you're solving problems before they become a problem. But what do you think people need to understand about caregivers and their experience? Because it's extremely difficult. And you, as a caregiver, don't really have the luxury of feeling sorry for yourself or being weak.
So, you know, this is not my advice, but this is what I went through. So first of all, like I said earlier, when you become a caregiver, educate yourself. Learn as much as you can. You know, even knowing that there is no cure for it, but once you read more and more, you come to some type of understanding. Because what used to happen, every time I read something, I would cry. And then, you know, more you read, then you don't cry on that, you know, reading about it. So you kind of internalize it and say, okay, this is what is happening to others and this is happening to me. So that was education part of, reading part of it to me. If you are very much intent on, you know, looking at clinical studies, or some people, you know, participate in clinical study helping others, so that's another avenue. So that might find, okay, I'm helping the, you know, larger community by taking my loved one to some type of clinical study so other can benefit. In my wife's case, it was not possible because of her communication skill. She was not, you know, whatever clinical trial might be, they might be asking questions or whatever, so she would not be able to say, so we could not qualify for that. You know, then another thing I would say is plan for your future. You know, one of the most important thing is take care of your legal and financial issues, you know, handle them or, you know, work on them. And in legal, I would say the most important part is get your power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, because you'll be making a decision for your loved ones. And unless you have legal paper, you know, the system in America, the healthcare system, the hospital yeah. system is such that, you know, unless you have legal papers, you know, they will not take your word that, you know, this is what I want to do. You know, it has to
be
legal.
It's such good advice. It's so important to get all of the legal squared away. But I think, you know, as a caregiver, in addition to all of this and all of the practical, I think it's also exhausting. And you have found the support groups. And what are kind of the common experiences that you're finding with other caregivers and what you're going through?
So the support group I go to, you know, it so happens that there are a lot of people who come into that group and their spouses have the disease. So it's one-on-one. So what we caregiver, we find is we are, you know, we are like a quarterback in a football team. This is a football season, you know, and the team's job is to protect the quarterback. So unless you have a good team around you, so in my case, you know, I have a caregiver who come in the morning, my doctor is part of my team, some of my friends could be part of my team. So you have a team, then they can protect you, you know. So many of us, we find that we are playing the role of quarterback, you know. And in normal circumstances, what happens is, in the quarterback as a backup quarterback, or let's say, you know, succession plan, if you talk about politics, you know, president, vice president, speaker of the, you know, the, those are succession plan, right? There is no succession. If the one spouse who's a care partner, something happens to that care partner, the whole team falls apart. So that's a very sad part of this. So, you know, it's very important to keep having a self-care and keeping healthy is very,
very
important.
Well, and I think having the care partner and having the support is so important. And there's a story I read that you told about breakfast where you were very frustrated trying to get her to eat breakfast, and you were trying to, she likes music, so you were trying to sing and you were trying all these tools and they just weren't working. And then within a few days or the next day, you observed the care provider, not easily, but more effectively, more efficiently being able to feed your wife. And right. It kind of occurred to you that that different perspective and that different approach, I think what I extracted from your story was so important. And you were learning from this care provider and how they were feeding her.
So what was happening to me when she wasn't eating? So my mind, knowledge is power, but knowledge can cause you some misery also.
Oh, right.
Okay. So sometimes we are too smart for our own good thing, you know, good being. So what was happening when she wasn't eating, a thought would flash in my mind. A year and a half ago or something, the doctor had asked me, the neurologist, what will be the most difficult decision he'll be making? And I thought for a while, and I thought, you know, putting my wife in a nursing home, that would be very, you know, heartbreaking, because, you know, you have this oath, you know, until death do us part, you know. So I said, that might be the toughest one. He said, yeah, that will be tough, but have you thought about the day she would not eat? Are you going to tube feed her or not? And I thought about it.
And would she be tube feeding around the clock or at every meal?
Yeah. So what happens in the later stage of the disease, the brain becomes so damaged, then brain cannot give command to mouth to, you know, chew and swallow.
Okay.
So they just lose that function.
Mm-hmm.
So you can resort to tube feeding. But my answer to the doctor was that nature takes its course.
Mm-hmm.
But when I came home and I looked at my POA, it was very clearly written, no tube feeding, no artificial, you know, feeding, if mm-hmm. the quality of life is not going to get improved. So when my wife was not eating well, so all those thoughts would come to my mind and I would get a little frustrated, you know.
Sure.
And
so what I hear is she didn't realize, but you needed her to eat so you could feel more assured that she didn't need to be tube fed.
That's right.
Right. So that was very scary for you when she's not eating.
Yeah. So my caregiver, you know, she didn't have to think about all these things.
Right.
Her job was just, you know, so she's very, you know, loving person. So her job was to just, you know, feed her.
Yeah.
You know, and what happens in this disease, the person with the disease, they reflect your own facial expression, your mood. If I'm happy, if I'm smiling, she will smile. But if I'm frustrated, they sense it. They understand the body language very well. So with caregiver, you know, she would not be frustrated. You know, she's very loving, and that makes her eat, or, you know, that. So that.
Wow. So I think we just have to take a minute to kind of think about that, because there's a lot in there, and there's a lot in there as a caregiver. So as the primary caregiver, as her husband, and you're very practical in your approach, but you're still emotionally invested and you're connected, and it's scary and it's hard, and she's reflecting your emotions.
Right.
Right. And that puts, it's interesting. I think as I was, again, reading your blog and I was researching, and I thought, boy, when someone's kind of reflecting your emotions and you're feeling this, and I say the word burden, but it's not because we see the person as a burden, right? But you have these responsibilities that it can weigh you down, or you kind of rise up to the task, right? And I was so wowed, or kind of awestruck, I guess I would say, as I was reading in your blog and the journal, that you can recognize, looking back, how this task, or what you had been tasked with, ultimately made you a better person, where you became, you had been an engineer and you were very focused, and you believe that, you know, you were raised in a culture where you were meant to be very alpha and have this kind of strong personality, and how this has affected you, has made you a calmer person. And I thought, wow, is that powerful? And I think that's, you know, an important part of your experience and story for people to hear, because like I said earlier, there's just so much involved with being a caregiver. And I think it's important to understand your journey which you're documenting.
Right. And I've heard somewhere that somebody said that spouse cannot be a caregiver, you know. It's difficult, you know.
It is so, extremely.
Yeah. So I'm trying to do something, you know, as a spouse, you know, and being a care partner. Mm. Of course, along with, you know, my team, you know.
And so, of course, in there, you have to take care of yourself. And one of the ways that you're finding, and you're having a care provider also gives you an outlet where you can step away and you can take a break and you can catch your breath. And that's so important. And that's almost an understatement. It's critical that you be healthy mentally, spiritually, emotionally, because if you're worn down and exhausted, you can't be an effective care provider.
Right. And that is this may sound as a cliche, but when you go in the flight, you know, what does the flight attendant say? Mm-hmm. Put the oxygen mask on you before you help others.
Yeah.
So that's very true in this particular case, you know.
And so you have been practicing a new form of meditation, and you have a friend who, as it turned out, has become an expert and had gone away, I think, for 30 days and right. kind of mastered this type of mindfulness. I think they actually went to a retreat where there's no interaction, no talking. You can't even gesture or look at anyone. And I have four little boys running around. And as I was researching you, I thought, that sounds a little bit nice. But so this friend of yours was coming to visit and introduced you to this form of mindfulness. And I'll let you expand on it a little bit because I think I'll probably mispronounce the name of it.
Yeah. So the mindfulness is called Vipassana meditation. Now, my friend does it. But now with my, you know, wife's situation and not having enough time, you know, so I cannot go away for, you know, even one day for, you know,
as can most, many, right? Yeah, most people
so,
can't.
So what I found is,
it's nice to have friends who can.
So living in present and mindfulness. So what is mindfulness? One definition I heard was very well heard that being aware of what is happening while it happens. So with my wife's situation, if she's angry, you know, and I have to be aware that she's angry. Maybe something is wrong. Just, you know, divert her, do something different, you know, give her a piece of, you know, grape or something and just, you know, she'll be fine. So I have to be aware of all the time, you know, what is happening, you know, in the situation while it happens. So now that is you learn from by practicing, you know, this meditation or any meditation, basically. I don't have that luxury. So, but I'm learning the meditative part, but just by being a care partner.
Well, I like that this form of meditation that you're applying, three kind of pillars of this, it turns greed into generosity, anger into compassion, and ignorance into wisdom.
Right. So greed is, you know, we all have greed. We are all, you know, we want to accumulate. We want to acquire. You know, greed could be hedonistic, right? Just loving luxuries and loving everything. In my case, you know, the greed is my own self time. So I have my own time. I want to do on my own luxury or whatever. Now that I have to convert into service for her. So my, instead of it is my time, it is her time. For example, yesterday I was, you know, having my breakfast and she woke up. I was half finished. Now, as soon as she woke up, I had to, you know, take care of her. So I left all my breakfast and everything half finished, you know, took care of her. And hour later, maybe I, you know, resume my breakfast. So greed could be, yes, I want to do my own before I help her, but I have to put her first, you first, and, you know, me second. So going back to the anger, we all get angry in many situations. Things don't work out in our favor, or we have expectation and we don't meet the expectation, or somebody doesn't meet our expectation, and that creates a lot of anger. So if anger can be, you know, converted into compassion, compassion is, you know, okay, other person did something, maybe there is a reason for it, you know. If my caregiver, you know, shows up 30 minutes late, for example, I don't have to get angry about it, you know. Maybe, you know, something happened in her life. It's not a life or death situation for me. So it's not a work situation in my case, but still, you know, I can be very demanding. So that part of compassion, you know, I'm developing more and more, trying to see where the other people are coming from. And the third part is ignorance into wisdom. Now, the opposite of ignorance could be knowledge. But here they say not knowledge, but the wisdom. Now, how does the wisdom come? So, you know, everybody's wisdom is different, you know, and wisdom, it is generally believed that you become wise as you get older. It doesn't have to be that way. There are younger people who can be very wise also. But the way I look at it, wisdom is a combination of your knowledge, your skills, your experience. So we go through the life, you know, all these three. So let's say, you know, you put it in a drum and roll all those things and you inject self-insight, mindfulness, self-analysis, contemplation, and what comes out, hopefully, is the wisdom. Mm. Now, everybody's wisdom could be different. So, you know, one way to look at wisdom is, you know, there is no things like black and white. You know, there is always a gray area. There is a middle ground, a middle way, you know. So if you can find a middle way in every situation, maybe that's one wisdom.
And then in addition, ways that you are taking care of Sumi as well as yourself is walking and staying active.
Yes.
Holding hands.
Yes.
Right? Touch is so important. You've also found that you like art classes.
That's right.
And that is a form of escape for you, right? Yes. Which is so fair and so important, and found that in those classes, it gives you a chance to just disconnect and you forget what's going on, which is important, right? To have that chance to just kind of recharge your battery. You also mentioned, which I really like, the 5 love languages.
Yes, maybe I can talk about that, you know.
I would love that. We have about 5 minutes left and I would just love to focus on this.
Okay, so I read the book, you know, the 5 love languages, and then the same book was written from the disease point of view, Alzheimer's point of view. So the 5 love languages are word of affirmation. That being like telling somebody, oh, you look great, you know, you are fine, you know, just praising somebody, but not, you know, very sincerely. And in normal life, people love to hear that. But with person with the disease, I have to tell, maybe I must have tell every 10 or 15 times, you know, within 1 hour, you know, Sumi, you look great, you are, you know, love you, you know, you're fine, you know. So that affirmation does make her, calm her down. The second is quality time. I mean, in her case, we can't, you know, spend a lot of quality time, but there are moments of quality time when we walk together. Maybe it's a quality time for her.
You make sure you're not just walking, but you're walking and you're holding hands.
Oh, yes.
Because there's the power of touch.
That's right. Now, the gift is giving and receiving gift. Now, I remember one incident, you know, I was feeding her. Now, people with the, you know, disease, they don't have any possessions. They don't know what is jewelry or, you know, clothes, or they don't have, you know, any sense of, you know, value system is different. So the one thing they possess is the food in front of them. They know it is their food, you know. So one time I was feeding her and she picks up a piece of sweet, and she's trying to put in my mouth. So to me, that was her way of gifting me something which belonged to her. So that was very touching that day, you know. Act of service, normally what we do in act of service, let's say one person cooks, other person does dishes or this or that yard work, so you share, you know, so that's, or unexpectedly, I do sometimes with my wife's caregiver. Even if they're busy, if the dishes are in the sink, I just clean everything for them. So when they come out, they think, oh, they have to clean the dishes, but it's already cleaned and everything is, you know, done. So that's my act of service to, you know, people around me. And so if my caregivers are taken care of, they will take care of my wife better. So that's how I look at it. And of course, physical touch. We all know that physical touch is very important. And in this particular case, person with the disease, the physical touch is very important. And there is one poem I would like to read. And that basically, I know we are, you know, short on time. That basically summarizes, you know, every time I read this poem, I have cried. And I don't want to cry on the
poem. Do you want me to read it?
Yes, please read that. So
I'd be honored. Well, I might cry now. Okay. Do not ask me to remember. Don't try to make me understand. Let me rest and know you are with me. Kiss my cheek and hold my hand. I'm confused beyond your concept. I'm sad and sick and lost. All I know is that I need you to be with me at all cost. Do not lose your patience with me. Do not scold or curse or cry. I can't help the way I'm acting. Can't be different, though I try. Just remember that I need you, that the best of me is gone. Please don't fail to stand beside me. Love me till my life is done. Oh, I know, now we're all crying. Oh, you are such a sweet soul, Casey. And you know, I want to thank you for sharing your journey and creating this blog and sharing your story. It's so important that caregivers are connected and sharing their experiences and finding that strength and support. And you've created something really, really special, and it's helping a lot of people. And I really applaud you for being an incredible husband, an incredible caregiver, and sharing a very private experience and helping so many people. Thank you.
Yeah, I hope, the listeners, if they're going through difficult situation in their lives, they find comfort and inspiration, from the way I look at it. I have taken a lot in my life from, my work, my income producing, but I'm at a stage where I want to give back. I want to just be, in service of others.
Where can we find your blog? Where can people follow you?
Well, right now it's just among family and friends. So I haven't figured out, how to go beyond that. Maybe you can help me. Is there something I can do where, I can reach out to more people?
Okay. We can absolutely help you find something, and we can definitely share some of these stories connected to the podcast. And thank you for being here, and thank you for sharing your story. I really, really appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you, Daniel, very much.
This has been the Karma Has Spoken podcast. If you like today's content, feel free to share our show by email, social media, or any other means. If you've got a question, comment, or other feedback, visit our website at karmahasspoken.com. Keep up with us by subscribing to Karma Has Spoken in your favorite podcast app, or follow Karma Has Spoken on social media. Karma Has Spoken is a production of Jag and Detroit Podcasts.